From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Protests continue across the United States over police killings of black Americans. More than 150 people were arrested in California Monday, where protesters blocked a major highway and forced an Amtrak train to stop. In Washington, D.C., demonstrators halted traffic on a street a few blocks from the White House. And in Brooklyn, New York, another rally was held, which led to scuffles and arrests. Press TV's Colin Campbell filed this report.
After a tumultuous weekend between demonstrators and police officers and nationwide protests, a fresh round of demonstrations began the week as how it ended. Angry over the failed indictments of white police officers who caused the deaths of unarmed black men in Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York, demonstrators clashed with police who fired tear gas and threw smoke bombs at them in Berkeley, California. There were also reports of rioting and looting in the West Coast city. In Washington, D.C., New York, and Chicago, protests were largely peaceful. Hundreds of individuals participated in die-ins as people lay down scattered in the streets to symbolize the deaths of unarmed individuals by the hands of police.
Again, we take a deep breath.
They chanted, "I Can't Breathe," a tribute to Eric Garner, who died in a banned chokehold by police officer Daniel Pantaleo in July. In an answer to heavy criticism, New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton said an internal investigation into Garner's death has already begun. President Obama, who has also faced scrutiny for not being vocal enough against unlawful police conduct, tried to pacify protesters, saying that progress takes incremental steps.
Painful as these incidents are, and we can't equate what is happening now to what was happening 50 years ago. And if you talk to your parents, grandparents, uncles, they'll tell you that things are better.
Demonstrations are ongoing as the Department of Justice announces new guidelines that ban federal law enforcement from profiling on a wide range of personal differences and preferences. Despite assurances from the federal government, the desire to protest doesn't look like it will die down anytime soon. Analysts are now evaluating the effects of demonstrations on the U.S. economy during the busiest shopping season of the year. Colin Campbell, Press TV, Washington.
The U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence released its long-awaited congressional report detailing the CIA's use of torture following a four-year-long investigation conducted at a cost of more than $40 million.
The report released today examines the CIA's secret overseas detention of at least 119 individuals and the use of coercive interrogation techniques, in some cases amounting to torture.
That was Senator Dianne Feinstein speaking Tuesday at the U.S. Senate. The report disclosed some of the actual practices employed by the CIA and other U.S. officials and contractors.
In November 2002, an otherwise healthy detainee who was being held mostly nude and chained to a concrete floor died at the facility from what is believed to have been hypothermia.
It also provided some insight into the character of the interrogators used by U.S. officials.
Due to the CIA's redactions to the report, there are limits to what I can say in this regard, but it's a clear fact that the CIA deployed officers who had histories of personal, ethical, and professional problems of a serious nature. These included histories of violence and abusive treatment of others, and should have called into question their employment with the United States government, let alone their suitability to participate in a sensitive CIA covert action program.
Feinstein said that the report proved that the CIA had lied.
The CIA provided extensive inaccurate information about the program and its effectiveness to the White House, the Department of Justice, Congress, the CIA Inspector General, the media, and the American public.
The senator suggested that there were lessons to be learned from the disclosure.
History will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law and the willingness to face an ugly truth and say never again.
Nevertheless, a dozen years after the use of torture by the U.S. government was first made policy, not a single person has been charged with a crime. The report was released Tuesday on the eve of Human Rights Day, observed annually on December 10th, which commemorates the adoption by the UN General Assembly of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
2014 has been described by the United Nations as a year of daunting human rights challenges. The remarks were made in Geneva on Tuesday on the eve of Human Rights Day, observed annually on the 10th of December. The day commemorates the adoption by the UN General Assembly of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. Rupert Colville is a spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
2014 will be remembered as a year of really daunting human rights challenges. In places where only recently there had been some progress in achieving human rights has now been retreat. Nonetheless, there have also been significant advances in human rights elsewhere and many incremental improvements in many different countries.
This year's Human Rights Day theme is Human Rights 365, which encompasses the idea that people around the world should enjoy their rights every day of the year. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Last Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution recommending that President Obama send military aid to Ukraine, strongly condemning Russia for a variety of alleged violations of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and recommending more sanctions. The measure was approved by a vote of 411-10, with only 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans voting no. Many observers termed the resolution a declaration of Cold War version 2.0. Mark Sloboda is a senior lecturer and researcher of international relations and security at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Tuesday. So, Mark, last week we have this resolution passing the House of Representatives in the U.S. by 411-10, more or less directing Obama to arm the Ukrainian military in its assault on the people in the East, and accusing Russia without reciting any evidence of all kinds of high crimes and misdemeanors, and prescribing more sanctions and essentially laying out a Cold War in detail. And then a response, I guess, is starting to stir in Moscow and the Duma. What do you see all this leading?
Well, I think you actually said it best the way you just put it. This resolution, at the very least, officiates the new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia. Now, this new Cold War is a Cold War 2.0, if you will. It's on completely different ideological lines. The geographical boundaries of it are much restricted by Russia's power horizons to her immediate near abroad and her country herself. But the rapprochement between the West and Russia is over. And this blustering resolution officiates that. And I think that's where we're standing right now in, diplomatic relations between particularly the U.S. and Russia, but also largely the entirety of the West, as the U.S., hegemon particularly controls to a large extent, much of the rest of the West, so they don't really have an independent foreign policy. I think that this resolution is a lot of bluster. I mean, Congress does not run the foreign policy of the United States.
Right, it has no force of law. More an advisory.
It is an advisory. It sets the tone of relations.
Right.
And I think we can accept that while the executive branch still runs foreign policy. Obama is an extremely weak president, particularly on foreign policy. I mean, criticism across the board that he really has no foreign policy. So that added to his domestic situation as a lame duck with a hostile Congress and Senate. And we've got this resolution where the House, and we do see bipartisan consensus, so it's certainly not just one party or the other, but
practically unanimity. I mean, it's more than just consensus. It was 411-10 and a few abstentions, yeah. So you're talking like 95% consensus.
Yeah, it's across the board. Yeah, the situation is really bad. I mean, and Ron Paul and Denis Kucinich, figures who used to be in the Congress on the alternative right and the far left, have both condemned the resolution, and they've gone so far as to say that it is setting the prelude for a hot war with Russia. Now, I don't necessarily believe that is the case. That might be jumping the gun, but I mean, we are at a situation in Ukraine where, in many ways, I think we are at the level of the Cuban Missile Crisis between tensions between Russia and the U.S., if not worse. I mean, we, in the entirety of the Cold War, we never had a proxy war in Europe. Right. We are looking at a hot proxy war in Europe.
On the border of Russia.
Yeah, with Russia. I mean, we know that there are Russian and U.S. military advisors on the respective sides of the regime in Ukraine and the rebels in the east in the Donbass, military advisors on both sides in the field, directing artillery, directing military strikes, special operations. This is an extremely dangerous situation. And unlike the Cold War, there are no set diplomatic rules or laws of engagement here, right? We haven't established any kind of detente idea of that these are the rules of the Cold War game. The Cold War was largely played by these rules, right. And we do not have these rules right now. And as an U.S. military myself, we know that conflicts are most likely in these situations because of accidents, because of mistakes, because of misunderstandings. Yeah. And this situation scares me. Not so much because I believe that the elites in the U.S. or Russia are intent on war with each other, but we have taken it to the brink, and military accidents in these situations do happen. And I think everyone needs to consider how serious this situation is. I mean, we thought that this kind of brinkmanship between nuclear armed powers was over, and it's not. It's back with a vengeance.
Let me ask you, I want to get to the point about what you think is driving this, but first, just for the audience, for the purpose of analogy, you have perhaps a pre-revolutionary condition in Mexico right now, which borders the United States on the south, much like Ukraine borders Russia to the southwest. And if you were to have, for example, Sergei Lavrov show up in Mexico City, egging on the protesters there, making speeches like John McCain did, handing out cookies like Vicky Nuland did, and funding to the extent of $5 billion, as Nuland bragged, the opposition in Mexico, and then offering armed assistance to a government that came in by way of revolution, coup, whatever. What do you think the United States would feel if Russia were engaged in this way on the southern borders of the U.S.?
Well, I mean, let's not even bother to mince words here. If the shoe was on the other foot, as it were, the United States would declare war. There's no question. The U.S. Sense of national interests, of national security, I mean, that demands wars in countries halfway around the world for far less than this. Right. So, of course, the U.S. would not allow the same situation to occur. And this is exactly what has occurred in Ukraine. For the audience's information, my wife is from the Crimea. And I have family all over eastern and central Ukraine through her in-laws, including in Donbass at the barricades. The people there do not accept the West-backed regime, the putsch that has seized power since February in the Ukraine. This is largely an issue of identity struggle with one side of the country against the other. one, the East versus the West of the country, a Western-leaning West and a Russian-leaning East. They will not accept this regime for both ideological, cultural, and political reasons, and they will fight to the end for it. And it's no surprise that the people in Russia not only support the government's roles, many people here in Russia think the government, the Kremlin, has been extremely weak, appeasing even. The Russian people, via civil society, are making far more donations in terms of everything from, food and medical aid all the way up to weapons, far more than the Russian government is actually providing. And we see a large number of Russian volunteers, volunteers from Kazakhstan, volunteers from across the former Soviet Union, even European anti-fascist volunteers.
From Spain, France. Yeah, right, I know. Yeah.
Spain, there's some Americans there, French. There's even an Afghan freedom fighter. There are Chinese there.
Right.
I mean, this is not just an issue. This is not a case of Russian regular army in the Ukraine. Whatever NATO and the U.S. military might say, that is a flat-out lie.
And whereas the U.S. Congress is halfway to authorizing direct military aid to, this sense of the Congress resolution that they passed instructs the president to provide military aid to the Kiev government.
Yeah, let's forget the, I think it's a red herring issue to talk about military aid. Military aid is already being provided
right.
to
That's
Kiev.
Correct.
Right, we are the West is propping up this regime, a regime that is literally bombing and mass murdering cities full of what it refers to its own people, with tens of billions of dollars, along with so-called non-lethal aid and everything. For people who are paying attention, they are aware that NATO is actually providing the Kiev regime with heavy gear, tanks, artillery, jets, and so on from old 1980s Warsaw Pact supplies of the same type out of Hungary and Romania. So when you're paying for a bullet or paying for a soldier or a mercenary to go kill, you are already providing lethal aid.
Yeah,
so
right, yeah.
In any way, the support of this regime is support of the war, whether the U.S. is actually sending, M1A1As small arms or anything of the sort over. And you know, we always find out that the CIA has been doing these sorts of things, behind our back years afterwards in such situations anyway. So the U.S. is already providing aid that is keeping this regime's war machine against its own people going. One thing I wanted to say is where the analogy of Mexico to the U.S. fails in this particular situation is that it completely fails to understand what Ukraine and Russia are to each other.
Right.
These two countries are only separate countries for the last 20 years. All right. For only a handful of years in the entirety of the last 2,000 years of their existence, have they ever been separate countries?
Right, that's right.
Russians regard Kiev as, I think, historically,
the
rightfully,
first Russian city, right? Yeah.
Yeah, as the first Russian city, the heart of their own civilization, the Kievan Rus civilization. This goes all the way through, Russian, the history of the Romanov Empire, up through the Soviet Union, up to, just the 1992. It is extremely hard to find someone in Western Russia or Eastern Ukraine who does not have family and close friends on either side of the border.
Right.
They regard themselves as the same people.
And there was no border until 1992.
There was no border in 1992.
Right.
And I just got word out of some of the towns around the Lugansk area that are besieged. And they are not only under military siege, but they are under egregious economic and humanitarian siege at this moment. They are now rationed to 250 grams of bread a day. That's what they're surviving on. And that's just double what people were surviving, or not surviving, as the case may be, in the siege of Leningrad in World War II on. That is how horrific the humanitarian situation is in much of eastern Ukraine right now. There is no economy. There is no heat. There is no electricity. There is no there's no water in many areas. They specifically, the Ukrainian regime particularly targets all of these types of utilities. These are war crimes. Right? Let's not mince any words. Besides the use of cluster bombs, phosphorus, indiscriminate artillery directed at cities full of people, simply targeting the utilities, they are preventing life from being able to continue. This is ethnic cleansing. There's no two words. There's no equivocation. This is a type of ethno-political cleansing. If these people will not submit to this new regime and its unlawful, unconstitutional seizure of power, then they will be cleansed. And the regime, the prime minister and the president, have both used specifically those words. They have referred to the people in the east who are resisting them not only as terrorists, but as subhumans.
That's right.
On more than one occasion. That's right. And that they must be cleansed in those words. The Western press is not reporting it. Why is the Western press not reporting this? Because Russophobia is entirely approved by the Western elites. It's this hatred of Russians, because it goes a little bit further than just the idea of fear. This is a form of racism. And in the minds of the West, because Russia is an outlier or outright rejecting their hegemony, their European civilization, the people that adopt that identity are less than human. And if you have to break a few eggs to make this cake, in their minds, or a few thousand eggs, in this case as the situation is,
so far,
so be it.
Let me ask you, okay, let's get to this point. You had a condition up until the recent hostilities in Europe, for example, where there had been a considerable amount of business being done between the EU and Russia, particularly with Germany and some other members, too, did an awful lot of business with Russia. There were some strong possibilities for economic cooperation across the board. And all of that has been shuttled aside in favor of this new policy of hostility towards Russia, orchestrated by the United States, pretty much rammed down the throats of a number of European countries. And think of the ship deal with Russia, with France and Russia, and a number of business deals with Germany, in a situation where the European economy really can't afford to walk away from solid business deals. What's
driving? A large portion of the EU is still in recession or teetering on recession. Its strongest economies, such as Germany, just avoided recession by a half of a percent.
Right. So what's driving this policy, since it seems to be counterproductive economically? Because something is driving it. What do you think that is?
So everyone knows that the U.S. is driving this situation. The State Department has been quite clear, forcing the hands behind the back, pushing forward a number of EU countries, towards the sanctions regime, towards, the crisis situation in the Ukraine. But we can't, I think, simply lay the blame at the feet of the United States, because that completely denies any political agency to the EU. And while there are some EU countries that are having to be dragged, to this pond to drink, there are a number of others, and I'm thinking of the governments in Germany, the governments in the United Kingdom, Poland, the Baltics, Sweden, that are themselves driving this situation. And we should not believe that EU foreign policy elite don't have geopolitical pretensions of their own and don't have ideological, liberal imperialist design that are driving this forward. It is the EU, after all, that declared
when the whole debacle began with this EU association agreement, this neoliberal shock therapy agreement that they tried to force on the previous Yanukovych government in the Ukraine, they said that the Ukraine must make a civilizational choice. You know, and when you have an ethnically divided country, as the Ukraine is, it was an immediate recipe for disaster. Anyone who knows the Ukraine knew where this would lead. I mean, people have been talking about the possibility of civil war in the Ukraine for, over a decade now, or if not two decades. That was pure lunacy to try to force such a situation on the Ukraine.
What drives it here in the United States? Because I'm interested in how Washington sees this as being in their interest. What interests are they pursuing?
Okay, so for the United States, the number one interest in this situation, I believe, and I think we've seen quite clear, is the United States is geopolitically focused that Russia will never become an independent center of geopolitical power again. And specifically, they're looking at the Eurasian Economic Union. Hillary Clinton, when she was still the Secretary of State, referred to this union, this capitalist union, as a reformation of the Soviet Union, which is simple lunacy. And that the U.S. would do everything in its power to stop it. View, and I think they have the correct stance, that for the Eurasian Union to succeed, it really needed the Ukraine as part of this joint economic trade area. And they have pulled out all the stops. The U.S. does not care about the Ukraine per se. It certainly does not care about the Ukrainian people. Right. It is willing to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian person.
Right.
They are concerned about Russia as an independent geopolitical center of power in the Eurasian continent. And they win in this situation. The U.S. has played their hand very skillfully, no matter what. Whether the Ukraine is left a civil war devastated wreck or brought fully into the West, it denies Russia Ukraine.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.